Tonight we're going to talk about the two of the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of feelings. And primarily, I'll be focusing on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the four foundations. And mindfulness, to me, is living and being exactly in the present moment, being completely in the present moment. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but being fully in the present moment can be really, really hard. We get, you know, actually I read somewhere where it talks about, you know, we're very selective with the input that actually comes into our minds, that we can block out 1,000 different things, but one thing will come in and then we'll just get stuck on that and sort of forget everything else. And to be fully mindful is actually to allow everything to come in, to be aware of everything as it comes in, but not react to what comes in. It's just that knowledge. It's sometimes called bare attention. And the four foundations of mindfulness, you know, each foundation, you know, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of dharmas are, you know, there are volumes in libraries that talk about these. And in our tradition is like each of these practices or mindfulnesses, we can do 100% fully to reach enlightenment, to reach freedom from suffering. And for me, one of the reasons that I really like this sutta, in the last 3 days I've actually been able to just be with these suttas, and I would listen to some Dharma talks, and then I would meditate, and then I would do a little reading, and then I would meditate. And there's just so much information on these teachings. And one of the things that I kept becoming really aware of is that even though there's a ton of this information, the whole purpose of it is to simplify, is to be just here right now. And so when I would start getting confused about this doctrine and this doctrine, it really didn't matter. I really came to the conclusion that it doesn't matter if I believe one viewpoint or another. What matters is that my intention to be mindful is there, and that my concentration and focus is to be in the present moment. And so any viewpoint that I take, odds are, is going to take me to that mindfulness and take me to that present moment. It's just my willingness to continue to be curious and to be willing and to have the desire to be mindful. The first two foundations, mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of feeling, one of the things I like about them is that they are very basic and very simple. It's like when we do the mindfulness of the breath, what we're doing is we are letting go of everything else and just focusing on one object. You know, a lot of the teachings say focus right around your nostrils and feel the breath going in and feel the breath going out. And when I asked you, you know, for your extra credit, to just sort of note the long breath and the short breath, what that does is it simplifies. It's like there's no secret tricks here. It's like, just note, this is a long breath. This is, you know, I'm breathing out. It's a long exhale. It's a long inhale. And by doing that, I'm letting go of all this other stuff that can distract me. And once I start developing a foundation, you know, the mindfulness of breathing is a great concentration practice, because every time my mind wanders, which it likes to do, it's like my job is to bring it back, you know, to my breathing. Is it a long breath? Is it a short breath? And then my mind wanders off again. Bring it back. Bring it back without judgment. And that's one of the keys also, is my mind likes to wander. My mind likes to chatter. My mind will do that for the rest of my life and for countless other lives. But I don't have to buy into that chatter. As I train it, bring it back to the short breath. Bring it back to the breath. And then as I become more comfortable, then I start exploring more. You know, one of the teachings is like, we are aware that it's a long breath or a short breath. And then there's an exploration of the breath body. Is actually in this teaching the third step in mindfulness of breathing. And so as I breathe in, and this is just one of the there are other ideas is what the breath body is or what but the way I'm looking at it now is like as I breathe in and I notice the breath going in my nostrils. And then it flows down into my abdomen. And then as I exhale, you know, it flows out. And being curious about how it actually flows out, because every breath that I take is different. Sometimes more air comes in one nostril than the other nostril. You know, other times it's the opposite. You know, sometimes, you know, it feels like certain parts of my belly fill up. And other times other parts. So it's constantly different and constantly changing. And so my attention when I'm breathing in and just studying the full breath is to be curious. And when my mind wanders, again, bring it back. And if I get confused following, you know, having my attention leave my nostrils to go down into my breath body, then I just return to where I'm no longer confused, where I'm stable. You know, as we explore mindfulness and as we explore insight, you know, the step is once I start to get confused or off center, then I go back to the place where I wasn't confused, where I was solid. I reestablish my mindfulness or my awareness, and then I continue. In this sutta, it's something I wanted to actually start out with, and I sort of got ahead of myself, is some of the reasons why I want to practice this. Is just out of curiosity, what are some of the reasons that you are interested in meditating? Okay. Gives you. Okay. 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 One of the reasons that the promises of establishing mindfulness that is in this sutta is that this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, and for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana. So it's for surmounting or overcoming sorrow and lamentation, and I just love that phrase. It's also for overcoming suffering, you know, whatever our suffering. So it's my desire to be in contact with reality. In many ways, for me, is my desire not to be swayed by my own delusions. My desire to be mindful is to be aware fully of what's going on. So again, I'm not swayed by my own delusions. I don't get carried off into my own fantasies and then suffer. I don't cling for this or cling for that because, you know, I realize that everything is impermanent. Everything changes. So some of these sorrows and lamentations that are very much a part of my life, because I am not aware of the true nature of things, I can overcome by practicing mindfulness of breathing. And so in some ways, what we were doing is, you know, being aware of the long breath, being aware of the short breath. One of the promises, if we practice this diligently, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected of him, either nibbana, final knowledge, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning. Actually, let alone 7 years, 6 years, 5, 1 year, 6 months, 2 months, 1 month, a half a month. If anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either nibbana or, if there is any trace of clinging, non-returning, 7 days. You know, you, by your practice of mindfulness of breathing, are actually, at this point, it's now 6 days and 23 hours and 30 minutes. You can reach full enlightenment. Free from suffering, completely in reality. Unfortunately, it's sort of like, I don't know if you've watched those TVs where they talk the drug medications and they talk about how, you know, you take this drug and then you'll feel great, and then at the very end they sit there and go, you know, may cause drowsiness, may do this, may do that, may do this. And with this, you know, you can reach, you know, enlightenment in 7 days, but you need to be clearly conscious. You need to be diligent in your practice. You need to be mindful. You need to be aware of the arising. You need to be aware of the passing away. You need to be aware of the external situations. You need to be aware of the external situations. You need to be aware of both of those situations. And so there's a few other things that we need to do to become fully mindful. And with the breathing practice, it again comes down to just being simple. You know, breathing in. And there are three main aspects of each of these, of all these practices actually. It's being ardent, it's being clearly understanding, and being mindful. And I sort of get a kick out of this, is here is a practice to establish mindfulness, and one of the ways to establish mindfulness is to be mindful. And the other ways is to be clearly understanding and to be ardent. And ardency to me is just being diligent. It's like every time something else, you know, once I choose my focus of attention and I get swayed off it, it's just returning back. It's like, I'm going to stay on this. And then the clearly understanding is knowing exactly what I'm doing at this moment. You know, right now my hands are sort of interlaced. You know, I can feel, I know where what my posture is. I have one leg touching the other leg. You know, I can feel the arc in my back. I've noticed that this hand has moved. And just being aware of all the movements in my body, even how my mouth is moving, which I was completely unaware of. But that is that clearly knowing. And then the mindfulness is remembering to be in this moment, to be present. And when I find myself just sort of going through and being ardent and trying to be totally aware of what my movements are, it's much easier to be in the present moment. So those are, you know, that's, you know, one of the main reasons that I practice mindfulness is that, you know, the sorrow and lamentations, the sufferings that are in my life, I don't want them to be a part of my life. And so with the four foundations, there are, you know, in some ways I look at it as a pyramid with four sides. You know, each side of the pyramid is going to take me up to a point where I am totally aware of, you know, the present moment. You know, all the things that are happening, but I'm aware of it with a solid foundation. And each side can take me up. But, you know, if I am aware of all the sides, I can actually utilize different parts at different times to actually make my stance and posture much more firm. Sort of like you have a thin stick that goes up and it's easy to sway. And, you know, maybe it's easy to sway. But with a pyramid, you know, it's a really solid base. And as I start my practice with mindfulness of the body or mindfulness of feelings, you know, I'm building this very strong base. There are six main body practices. And one of them is mindfulness of breathing. One of them is a pretty simple one. It's mindfulness of the body, you know, body postures. It's how are you sitting right now? You know, be aware of that. Throughout this whole, you know, the next 40 minutes, be aware of how you're sitting. Be aware of when you move and why. You know, just sort of note it. It's like, oh, moving. Oh. And then we have body activities. So it's like actually being aware. It's like when we walk, is walking, and it's like, okay, moving my head, seeing this way. Moving my head, seeing this way. Walking, just being aware of the basic actions that we're doing. And then it gets into the fun stuff. You know, there's one meditation on anatomical parts. There's one on the four elements. And then there are the cemetery meditations, which we actually won't talk about here. But there are 9 cemetery meditations. And part of these, the meditations are to, some of them I see as ways of developing or making me aware that everything is impermanent, and also that I am not really my body. You know, the anatomical parts are the example that is used in the sutta is, you know, sort of visualize a bag with a hole at the top and a hole at the bottom. And then there are all these different beans. You know, you have green beans or black beans. You have rice. You have little bags of stuff. So you open up the bag and you sort of look in, and it's like, what's in there? And then do that with the body. So it's sort of like you sit there and you open up your mouth and you look down and you see the pus, you see the tongue, you see the ribs, you see the nails. And you look at them basically like beans. You know, here's what makes the body. And it sort of changes your outlook on your body. Because, you know, I have this image of how I want to look. But if all of a sudden it's like, yeah, I'm just this, you know, a bag of junk, you know, that, you know, somebody takes off to the market. I think the human body's worth like $1.96 or something if they sell it. It's you know, for all our metals and stuff in there. It's not a whole lot. And that's, you know, actually that probably if I sell livers and hearts and stuff like that, I could get a little bit more. But it's hard to be mindful without a heart. So these teachings are about letting us look at ourselves in a more objective way. And one of the practices that I would like to do is, you know, all these teachings, they all have a couple elements that are universal to them all. And one of them is, as you're doing whatever practice you're doing, let's say mindfulness of breathing, is, you know, you need to be aware of the arising of the breath and the passing away of the breath. You need to be aware of the breath internally and externally. And for being aware of the rising and passing away of anything, and taking the breath is very easy, but you can do this with all the everything. It's sort of like the posture that I have right now, my positions. My hands are here. As I move my hands, you know, there is a change. You know, there is an arising and a passing away. With the breath, there are 4 stages, traditionally 4 stages in the breath. It's the beginning of the breath, the middle of the breath, the end of the breath. And then there's the pause in between. And so for the next, 2 minutes, I'd like you to just close your eyes and see if you can notice the beginning, the middle, the end of that breath, and then even the pause. And notice it as you practice with the awareness that everything arises and everything passes away. And you are getting, this breath can be a life. This breath can be 100 lives. You know, so just be aware of the arising and passing away. We'll sit for about 2 minutes. So how did, does anyone have any comments or observations?
But now that you've brought it up, when we bring it in, we are drawing oxygen-laden air to our lungs. And when we stop breathing, that's when that oxygen is distributed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I thought about. And that's a pretty important part of that process, just for that oxygen to be distributed.
It's very helpful, yeah. Anyone else?
When I was just really trying to concentrate on breathing in a concentrated way for the next 2 minutes, all of a sudden I couldn't relax enough to really make my breathing worthwhile to concentrate on.
Okay.
Whereas if I had just, you know, just about the time when you were ready to ring the bell, my breathing became relaxed.
Mm-hmm. And one of the tools there is just noticing that it's uncomfortable to breathe. In some ways, was that an unpleasant feeling?
It was odd.
Okay. One of the, you know, when we practice in that way, you know, we bring mindfulness of breathing as we just sit focusing right here is a phenomenal concentration practice, because it's very simple and it's very clean. When we actually start expanding the awareness, that's when insight will start to flow in. You know, being aware that things pass away, being aware and being able to see the breath as the in-breath, just as it begins to come in, is just a powerful way of noticing that things are impermanent. You know, the breath passes away. You know, I have a picture in my house of my parents when they were, when they had just gotten married. And I have several pictures of them now when they're 90s. And one of the things that's so powerful for me is to see, you know, here is this evolution. And for my dad, you know, he sits there and he goes, I am just amazed that it's gone so quickly. You know, and he goes, I don't know why I'm still alive. But he's not saying it in a negative way. It's just like, wow, I've made 90. It's like, and for me, I look at those pictures of a very youthful and excited couple. And then here's this loving, you know, 90-year-old couple. And it's this change in evolution. It's like all things are impermanent. And, you know, one of the things that my dad said about 20 years ago was that, well, I hope that, you know, I die, your mother dies before me. And the first time he said that, it's like, that's really rude. That's, you know, that's sort of cold. And then I started thinking about it and realized that what he was saying is that they loved each other so much that, or they love each other so much that my dad did not want to see my mom in grief and anguish over losing her partner. And what he was saying is, I want to take that grief on and not have her do it. And I actually, when I realized that that's what my dad was saying, it was like, you know, my esteem for him just sort of went up a couple notches. And I actually brought that up to my parents a couple years ago, and my mom goes, well, he better die before me, or I better die before him. And it was just the way their relationship was. And it's like they were a partnership, but it's going to pass away, and one of them is going to die first. And, you know, I may very well die before they die. You know, I don't know, but the point is everything changes. And my suffering is multiplied if I cannot accept that fact. You know, I will grieve when my parents die. But I will not be shocked or say, I just, you know, this is totally unexpected. All that stuff is already, I already know. You know, everything arises, everything passes away. And that's what one of these teachings, you know, though very, very simple, teach us, you know, how to live our lives in a very, very rich way, to live in this present moment, because this moment will never come back again. So if I decide to put off something till tomorrow, you know, that's a crapshoot. You know, tomorrow may not come. If I want to talk to someone about something, if I want to tell my parents that I love them, it's like, I better do it now. I better not wait until tomorrow because that may not happen. And then I would have to live with, oh, if only I had said this when I had the opportunity. It's like the opportunity to say this is now. And sitting gives me that insight. Sitting gives me the insight of impermanence. Another practice I would like to do is also in the body section, and I've chosen this one because it's a simple one, but it's about sort of expanding actually our view of for me for meditation. When I read this practice and started reading, because they talk about, you know the practice both internally and externally. And a lot of the teachings will say it's like, you know it for mindfulness of the body, and we'll focus on body postures. I know my posture. It's like, okay, I'm sitting as I'm sitting right now, and I'm very aware of where my hands are, where my feet are, where my butt is, where my head is, for the most part. And so that's knowing it internally. And the other part is knowing it externally. And some of the commentaries say that means actually being aware of subjectively how somebody else is sitting, somebody else's posture. So sort of look around and it's like seeing all the people here. And in your head right now, I'm giving you a little cheat sheet right now, is pick someone that you want to be in their posture. And then close your eyes and be aware of your posture. And note how you're sitting, the space you're taking up in the room. Just be aware of your presence in the room. And now, move your attention externally. You know, how is another person sitting in this room? Then bring your attention back to yourself and how you are sitting. And if you can, open your awareness to how everyone is sitting. Does anyone have any comments on that exercise? I see a few smiles, but you know, for me, when I first started playing with this, You know, it was actually in an empty room, so it was very hard for me to visualize another person in the room. But what I noticed is that as I was doing it is that, you know, I became very aware that there are meditators meditating, you know, 24 hours a day. And so, you know, I was not alone in my meditation. But it also just opened up my awareness. So usually as I sit, it's like I'm in my little bill bubble, you know, meditating and focusing on my breath. But then all of a sudden it's like I change and I'm aware of other postures. And it's like the room just gets bigger. And I really like that because, you know, as far as mindfulness of the present moment, it's not this little bubble. It's this big space. You know, essentially it's like, you know, this whole world and universe. And I can get glimpses, you know, tastes, like, you know, I can expand my awareness without losing my mindfulness. And the more I expand it, the more awareness I have. And it's not a confusing type of awareness. And when things start getting hectic, it's like I can bring it back. So it's a way of being able to expand my awareness in a very controlled way. Does anyone have any questions, thoughts, or comments? Okay. You have all sorts of microphones.
Since everything is impermanent, are the suttas also impermanent? And if they're impermanent, it's impermanent, and so forth.
It's a good question. Actually, in some of the teachings, as Buddha said that, you know, his teachings would last approximately about 5,000 years, and then they would go away. And it will be basically because people will practice and then they will start studying the suttas and not practicing the suttas. And then you will find the suttas in libraries and the teachings will basically be forgotten until, you know, someone else comes along and revives them. And it's actually the Buddha said some of his teachings, you know, are not original. It's like he just rediscovered them again. He rediscovered the path. And so there's this cycle of the Dharma arising. You know, the Dharma is universal. And for me, what that means is that there is, I guess how I defined Nibbana is, you know, the emptiness is, you know, freedom from clinging and freedom from grasping. And there's a state where I can rest that is, it's called the deathless. And that is permanent. I don't know exactly what that is other than I know that it's, you know, it's a place of non-suffering. But everything else arises and passes away. So yet the suttas will pass away. And then there will be new suttas. And they'll say probably the same thing as the old suttas. But just in a different way.
I have one more question. In the state of, you know, when you reach the state of enlightenment in the state of nirvana, can those states, like you said, from 7 minutes to 7 years or 7 days, be reached, and as they're reached, they too become impermanent, and then they go back into suffering, and then back into freedom. So they're constantly perpetuating constant change, and that the change is the impermanence of impermanence.
Well, actually, there are four stages of enlightenment, and here it says if you practice these diligently, you will reach nirvana, which is the deathless. It's like when you die, you're not coming back. And then there's the, then it says if you have some clinging in your life, then you are a once returner, which means, my understanding means that you actually aren't reborn on this plane, but you're reborn on a higher plane, and you basically have one more lifetime and you will reach the deathless. One thing about exploring in impermanence in that scale is that it's real easy to get distracted. And it's not, we're no longer in the present moment. So even, you know, playing with that and being curious is definitely part of the practice. But always, for me, my motto is like, when I start getting confused, is like I go back to, you know, letting go of the suttas. What is the present moment? You know, how can I be here right now? And I really believe it's like that's actually a moment, if I can capture it fully, is the deathless, is complete, you know, the word that comes up is complete contentment for me. You know, and then it disappears. But so in a lifetime, it's that it comes and goes. I don't know if I answered it. It can be an exploration for you. Right now, I would like to get to mindfulness of feelings. And mindfulness of feelings on the surface is an extremely simple practice. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neither pleasant or unpleasant? And that's it. You know, the emotion stuff, it's like greed, desire, anger, all that stuff is actually a mind state. So next week, you know, once you've reached enlightenment by diligently and ardently practicing your body postures, you can come back and get a little bit more information about anger and stuff. But what these, you know, the reason that we just focus on pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant is that these are the seeds to our craving, to our clinging. These are the seeds to anger, desire, suffering. These are the seeds. So if we can reduce, you know, so actually by sitting and noticing in the body where something is unpleasant, or where something is pleasant, I actually have the first steps in understanding where my desire arises. Everything, you know, every craving that I have or every aversion that I have springs from either I like it, I don't like it, or I'm neutral about it. So while we're sitting, to just stay focused on something, you know, a pain in my knee comes up, you know, and I want to move my knee. I sit there and I notice, oh, unpleasant, unpleasant. And then there's a response. You know, every time in the big picture, you walk into a room and there's someone you don't like. You know, what do? Oh, unpleasant. And then there's a response. You move away. You move away just like you move your knee to relieve the uncomfortability. Same thing with something that's pleasurable. It's like, oh, this is nice. You move towards it. And so to be aware that that's what we're doing in the laboratory of our body gives us the opportunity to be aware that that's what we're doing in this whole, you know, passion play that we're living in these days. And that awareness gives us choice. The next exercise, and this is sort of, you know, I want to try and create some pleasant or unpleasant feelings for you all. So this is an artificial meditation. But first is sort of gently bite on your tongue. Do not bite through your tongue. That's another body meditation that we're not going to do today. But bite down and feel, and what do you feel? And I'm not asking anyone, you know, is it unpleasant? Is it pleasant? You know, it could very well just be like a tingling sensation that's neither pleasant or unpleasant. And with your eyes closed, you can let go of that, you can let go of your tongue, and then sort of visualize eating Brussels sprouts. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And through this, see how your body responds to what I'm saying. Not your mind. I'm trying to go back from some preconceived ideas that you have to the root, sort of a reverse engineering. So as you're sitting there, think about George Bush. Pleasant, unpleasant, neither. Where does that arise in your body? Hillary Clinton. Tropical beach. Creamed spinach. Cancer. Now bringing your right hand up to your cheek, just feel your cheek. Imagine that it's your lover touching your cheek. Imagine that it's a person that you do not like touching your cheek. Now be here in this room. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And you can open your eyes. Any comments or thoughts about that?
Through all those states of mind, I have a gamut of the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral kind of fusing together. I like discomfort and comfort because for me, I've been practicing being around some people who cause discomfort because they challenge me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that joyful a lot of times.
Joyful?
Yeah. And I'm neutral about it because I'm, like you said, exploring the different states, you know, like I was talking before. And why it is that way. Rather than, you know, kind of objectively, rather than judgmentally, just kind of experiencing it. So I rather enjoyed all those words.
Now, one of the things, and I don't know if this worked, were you able to feel in your body either pleasant or unpleasant sensations? Okay, I see nodding heads. Okay, and that's sort of, it's like here, you know, I started off with concepts, you know, the laughing at George Bush, which was a joyful laughing I saw, was, you know, we have this image of, you know, in each of us, and there are different images than what George Bush really is. And, you know, my interpretation and somebody else's are very different. And how the body responds to that. And that's where, as we focus just on pleasant or unpleasant, it's in the body. You know, I've been very aware as I've practiced mindfulness, especially pleasant and unpleasant. If, when I walk into a room or when I'm interacting with someone, you know, my stomach will, if I'm in an uncomfortable situation, my stomach will tighten up. And, you know, before I started practicing mindfulness, you know, all of a sudden there'd be a point where it's like, I got to get away from this person. And I would bolt. And now there are times actually it's like, oh, my stomach's tightening up. I'm not comfortable in this situation. So it actually tells me, my body will tell me that this is a situation that I'm not happy in. And then I'm able to leave it before I reach that point of, overload. It's like, this is not comfortable. And being aware of those subtle cues that the body tells us, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant or unpleasant, you know, it's an early warning system in some ways. But it's also a way of seeing the seeds of our hatred and our desires and actually our ignorance. And we have approximately 5 minutes, so I will leave this open for questions or comments or anything else.
This is very interesting because here at IMC we're considering some co-housing for our community. And, you know, obviously there are some people here who don't particularly want to live with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you might be interested in co-housing, and it turns out that the person you really don't want to live with is thinking of living in that same co-housing situation. And so people are thinking, well, this is an opportunity for practice. But is it really an opportunity for practice, or is it, as you're saying, a situation that you really want to avoid? And so I would just be interested in your comments on that.
You know, everything is an opportunity to practice. And it's... Yeah, so that's one part. The other part is how willing am I to... There's a sutta, and I can't remember which one, about... I think it was the Jains who would come in, and they would beat themselves to purify themselves. And they're going, this is the practice. And the Buddha said, no, what you're doing is you're beating yourself. And you're generating suffering. So that's not the practice, because what your action is suffering, is creating suffering. So you're creating more suffering. So in a situation with choosing to live with someone, is going in is like, is this an opportunity to practice, or is it an opportunity to just be miserable? And, you know, where is my practice? Where is my skill level? In, am I able to make this practice, or am I going to suffer? If you can make it practice where you grow beyond being irritated with this person, then it's a great tool. There's a story of Atisha, who is a Tibetan Dharma leader, I believe in the 9th century. And the Tibetans wanted him to come to Tibet, and they said, please, please, please come. The Tibetans are beautiful, lovely people. You will, you know, and we need the Dharma. And so he decided to come, and he brought his attendant with him, who was just this irritating person for Atisha. And he brought this attendant solely to practice compassion and to be with a difficult person. And he said, a difficult person is like a diamond in the rough. It's a precious jewel that we should protect with all our lives, because they teach us compassion. They teach us generosity. You know, the people you like, they really don't teach you compassion. The people you don't like, that you have to go out of your way to be nice to, because they are you on one level. But the important thing is where is your practice, and are you able to sustain an open heart or not? So how's that for an answer? You know, a lot of it, it's where you are. Any other questions, comments?
I really enjoyed the one practice where when we were sitting and noticing our own, how we were sitting ourselves, and then you had us look in our mind's eye at somebody else and how they were sitting, and this expanding and contracting and kind of going in and out, and it really made me much more aware of my own body when I started looking at somebody else's body, that all of a sudden I was looking at where his hands were, and did he have a, was he sitting on a cushion or was he leaning on a cushion, and how his feet were and his leg, and then you brought us back, and then all of a sudden I realized more about my own posture, and I thought I'd kind of noticed pretty well how I was sitting before. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, thank you. And it is 9:00. So I would like to dedicate the merit of our practice tonight to those who are still suffering and to all beings. May all of us reach enlightenment.